Work-life balance and work-life integration are massive, massive issues for lots and lots of people, especially with the constant barrage of email and messages and phone calls and social media and the requirements of a job or a business. It's really, really tough for many people. So I actually took some time to speak with ex-FTSE 250 CEO turned tech entrepreneur Michael Tobin, OBE, Sir Michael Tobin, and he shared some amazing insights. But we are slightly concerned with the sound quality. So we have remastered it a little bit to make it better, but we're not 100% happy with it. But just he shared so much valuable information that we didn't want you to miss out on this amazing episode. So I'll get into it right now. Thank you. Here he is.
I think, you know, when you look at people that have tried to balance, you know, let's call it work and life, and I think about immediately comes to mind. I think about the great leaders of recent times, and people like Nelson Mandela, who was a great mentor to me and sort of inspiration to me, and yet he, you know, he was such a great leader in his time, in even before office, but during office as well. But at home, he was a disaster. And you know, he was divorced twice. His kids were arguing over his legacy before he was even passed away. And I think, you know, that's a typical example about when people are so focused on success in a certain element of their life, they feel that they just cannot, they don't even have time for the other part. And you kind of wonder whether that's real success or not, you know. And whilst it appears to be from the outside, because he, you know, he changed the world to an extent. And you know, people like Clinton, they're also, you know, great leaders, but again, home life, you know, let's not talk about it. It's a mess, right? So, you know, I think when you try to balance, if you are truly sort of driven and truly sort of you know, a successful or aspiring successful person, you tend then to allow one of those two things to suffer. And I think there's a different way, a way to get out of that, I think, is rather than try to balance, rather than sort of say, well, I'm going to give 100% to this, and then I'm going to stop, and then I'm going to give 100% to that. You know, if you think about it as an integration, then you shouldn't see a difference between work and life, right? It should all be the same thing. And then you can actually put 100% into it, because it is the same thing. You're actually putting 100% into a combined environment. There's a couple of examples. I mean, you know, that I can give you, but you know, I talk about this a lot in my second book, actually, called Live, Love, Work, Prosper, which is all about how work-life integration is the way forward. But imagine, I'll just put it one specific way around in terms of male and female here, but it works either way. But let's imagine that a woman's a young couple, young family, baby. The woman's got a sort of mid-management role, is one of several peers that's looking for the next step on the ladder, desperate for that one promotion place that's coming up soon, so that you know the family can prosper and they can get the next house and so on and so forth. That evening is coming home a bit later. The husband gets home a bit earlier. He's got bath time with the kid, and he says, "Look, you know, tonight I really want to go out with the lads, and we're going to have a drink. And I need you home on time, so please don't be late." So the woman says, "Yeah, fine, okay." She's leaving the office, and the boss comes along and says, "Emergency, I've got this really big, important report to do for tomorrow morning, first thing. You need to get it done. You know, no questions asked. This is really, really important." So then the pressure's on, right? The pressure's on the executive, young woman executive, to either decide between fulfilling her home commitment to getting home and taking over bath time so that the husband can go out, or staying and doing the work, or at least doing the work at home, which, you know, is sort of conducive to her career progression. So there's a conflict there between family and work immediately. Now, there was a report that a guy called Oliver James, who was a clinical psychologist, I interviewed for the book actually, but he did a report and he made a study of middle management at some point a few years ago, and he said out of the people asked this question, 74% of them admitted to lying to their partners about doing work at home. And I thought this was an incredible thing. And he said basically people were going into the bathroom, going into the toilet and saying, you know, oh, I'll be out in a minute, but taking their phone in and doing emails because they were so worried about being seen to be working at home when they told their partners they wouldn't. And then they'd end up lying to them about doing this. And this is, you know, it can't be a good thing that you come home and you start lying to your partner, regardless of, you know, how mundane or menial the topic is. Because then you go back into the office and then you say, oh, well, gosh, you know, all your peers are saying the same thing. That was really bad. And last minute, we had to do all this report and work. And how did, you know, we messed up all our plans at home. And suddenly you're lying to your partner, but you're endearing yourself to colleagues at work. And, you know, we all know the risks of office romance and everything else. But, you know, that's a tricky slope. That's a slippery slope to get onto.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, then they're all going to gather, aren't they, around the water cooler, and you know, yeah, it's got to be a difficult one. I mean, working from home's tough anyway, you know, but it's very difficult for people in work, especially if they want to achieve great things in you know, whatever career they're in. I mean, yeah. So what would you sort of recommend? You know,
I mean, in that particular instance, right? You can come home and then, you know, you go straight to the husband and go, good Lord. And you know what's just happened to me? This pain of a neck boss of mine, you know, look at the email he's just sent me. You know, I don't know what to do now. You know, my choices are these. Our choices, you and me together, same side. Our choices are these. One, I tell it to go and stick it. And I deliver my commitment to you so you can go out. It may mean that I don't get the promotion. And then that means that we probably don't get the house that we wanted, et cetera, et cetera. Two, I can say to him, all right, I'll do the work. And then you can call your guys and say, you're going to be 30 minutes late.
Yeah.
Right. So now instead of it being, a kind of an opposition at home, right. And you're siding with work against home. Now it's like them and us is the home environment against the outside world. And in, you know, you can imagine on that sort of situation where the guy in this case understands the two dynamics, you know, to be fair, we probably do need that promotion. So why don't you go ahead and do it? And I'll find a solution with the lads.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a really different approach, but it doesn't drive the wedge between work and life. It drives the, you know, it makes sure that, you know, there's more of a collegiate view of both of those things. And that's a simple example, but there are many other examples that are in the book.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely brilliant. It's very similar to business management, isn't it? Really, it's kind of like my dad used to manage, you know, quite a few people, and he would use the technique of sort of, he would know what the solution was to the problem, but he would sort of say, well, you know, we've got a problem here. What do you think we should do?
Yeah.
And it's a similar kind of thing, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, if you, you know, the difference between sort of leaders and managers today in business typically revolves around the fact that a truly great leader would simply have the role of creating more leaders around them. So the difference being, a manager will say, do this, do this, do this. Now, quite frankly, if you employ the best people you can possibly find in each role, they're probably better than you at their role. Hmm. And therefore, why would you be telling them how to do it? So you know, that the original, the sort of traditional view of a manager is like, everyone, I'm going to tell everyone to do this. And it's more sort of delegation. Well, there's a different way to delegate. There's a delegation of both responsibility and power rather than just responsibility. And you sort of say to people, well, look, you know what we're trying to achieve as an organization here. You know what we're trying to achieve as a team. What do you think in your capacity as the most informed, educated person within your space, what do you think is the best route forward? And then you're giving, you know, you're sort of engaging with people in a familial way, and saying, you know, as a team, as a group here, we're going to go forward, and we co-depend on each other, as opposed to, you know, you're all doing the stuff and I'm going to get the glory.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's the whole point of being in a team, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of think of, you know, this point, which is, I think Ralph Nader was one of the early guys that kind of articulated leadership like this. But you know, the only job you have as a leader is to create more leaders around you. And then, you know, that begats this empowerment. And my earlier book, Forget Strategy, Get Results, is a kind of it's a bit tongue in cheek, but Forget Strategy, Get Results really means don't apply so much of a prescriptive strategy to life and business, but prescribe a vision. And the subtle difference between strategy and vision is that, you know, you can have a vision that is unwavering, but how you achieve that vision can change second by second, minute by minute, day by day, because stuff happens around us that doesn't necessarily conform to a prescriptive order of things. So, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre said, in football, everything is complicated by the presence of the opposite team, right? And you can go with a great strategy and, you know, oh, we're going to go there and we're going to do this and you're going to cross the ball in from there. And but actually, unless you go and tell the other side in their changing room exactly your plans, they won't know your plans. Therefore, they're going to do something to mess them up.
Right.
Quite frustratingly, you know, the opposition always messes up your plans. Right. And so having a sort of a prescriptive process of how to get from A to B, especially in this disruptive world that we live in today, is not ideal.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, we have to have a vision and then have amazing people around us that are flexible enough to and adaptable enough to take all of the changes that are happening on a second by second live sort of basis and still flex to deliver that vision. And, you know, Darwin said, it's not the biggest or the fastest or the strongest or the, you know, that survive. It's the most adaptable that survive.
Right, right.
And this is ever more, you know, it was visionary for him to say it, but it's, and he was only looking back over, you know, tens of millions of years since dinosaurs. But actually, it's as applicable today, even more applicable today, especially in business, than it ever has been before because of the disruptive technologies we have around us.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's so much worry around this for employees and also for businesses, you know. And it's certainly worrying for quite a few people. But I think, you know, if you look at the next few years, there are so many jobs that haven't even been created yet. There are so many sort of technological advances that we haven't even really, you know, started embracing. And I'm quite enthused by the whole thing. I think that working hours should hopefully come down. I mean, they've promised us this since the first industrial revolution, haven't they?
Well, I mean, you know, if you lived in France, they would be enforced going down, but I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing either. And, you know, but if we're in an environment where we don't actually notice we're working, let's put it that way, right?
Yeah.
If we love, you know, footballers and, you know, sports people, they love what they do and they get paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, they're in a minority, obviously, across the globe. But you know, if we can aspire to finding a role that we love, then it doesn't feel like work when we do it. And therefore, you know, that allows us to integrate the concept of work and life much easier. Because, you know, part of your life, I mean, you often find people saying, you know, I could never retire because, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I enjoy going to work and I enjoy the interaction and I enjoy, you know, chatting with my colleagues and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Well, that's because that becomes part of your life.
Yeah.
Right. And if you take it away, you feel that your life is lacking in something.
Yeah.
And so you see a lot of people just not wanting to retire. You know? Right. And that's okay because they've got a great, you know, they've got a great, you know, situation where they can get paid to live their life.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of like outsourcing, right. I mean, cause I'm, you know, I'm obsessed with this podcast, but I've got some other work that I'm working on at the moment. And So I'm sort of looking at outsourcing. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna study outsourcing and I'm gonna learn about how to make it work for me. So I listened to a podcast yesterday about it. I think it was like a Harvard Business Review or, you know, a Harvard something or other. I don't mind Harvard, but my dad went to MIT. This, so did my grandfather. So there's a bit of like rivalry. But so I listened to it, and what they were saying was actually you should kind of look at the things that you really hate doing. So, for example, I mean, we're talking about work-life balance, yeah, and that's what actually that particular podcast was about. Was sort of, you know, if you don't like doing the washing, you need to think about. I mean, all right, you don't want to put an hourly rate on your salary, but in your mind, if you work for a company, there'll be an hourly rate in your head that you're earning. It might be £100, it might be 50, it might be 20, it might be, you know, 500, 1,000, whatever. But that was what they sort of said in there. So it was like, then you can begin to think, well, right, what is going to make me happier? Yeah. Am I going to stay at home and do all the washing and cleaning and everything else? Or am I going to hire someone in on a £10 an hour or whatever to come in and clean up my place? So that was kind of what that was about. And I found that quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a principle that I talk to people about when I do my lectures. It's the love it, leave it or change it principle. And if you don't like something or someone or some aspect of someone's attitude or something or whatever it is, right, you can apply this principle. So what you can't do is continue to accept the status quo of not being happy about something. Okay, that's not an option, because if you do that, you're actually disrespecting your own life, because you're just ruining it, right? But right. There are three options that you can then take an approach to that issue with. You either learn to truly love it, in other words, you accept it 100%, not begrudgingly, but you accept it. So, you know, with your washing thing,
yeah,
you know, you say, okay, well, I'm actually going to learn how to love doing the washing. I'm going to make it into some game. I'm going to, you know, bring the kids in with it, and we're going to throw each other the clothes in a long line, and they're going to go in, and we make a fun thing out of it, right? So yeah. You change it to something that becomes enjoyable. If you can't do that, which sometimes you can't, with relationships sometimes it doesn't work, or and so on and so forth, then you try to change it. So as you say, you know, if you look at your hourly rate, and there could be someone else that you can employ to come in and do your washing, or there could, you know, we have a guy come around and pick up our dry cleaning on a regular basis. So, you know, that's kind of the same thing. We're outsourcing.
Yeah.
We're changing the dynamic. We're not doing it anymore. Someone else is. And therefore I don't have that dislike again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much what that episode was saying, actually. Yeah.
Then there's a third thing, right? Because that's not always easy. You know, maybe you can't change a person, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can't learn to love it and you can't change it, then the option is leave it.
Right.
So you walk away. You stop doing it. In the case of washing clothes, well, you know, if you've tried to do all the other things and you're still not happy, then let's not wash any clothes. Let's buy really cheap stuff and just constantly buy new ones. And never have to wash again. But you know, in terms of people, you need to walk away from them.
Yeah.
Because if you've tried to learn to accept that dynamic and that hasn't worked, and you've tried to change that dynamic and that hasn't worked, the option is walk away or sit there constantly being unhappy.
Yeah.
As you said, that's not acceptable in life.
Yeah.
You're wasting your life on that basis.
Agreed. So, excuse me. So, stress management, right? I mean, this all causes stress, doesn't it? Like, if something is out of, I mean, yeah, there are many reasons you can have stress in life, right? I mean, there are personal reasons, health reasons, financial, work, you know, fulfillment, exercise, whatever. But like, it's so closely related, isn't it, that it's super interesting, work-life balance and stress management, but one can cause the other, right?
Yeah. I mean, so stress is something that you know, if we change the word to worry for a minute,
okay, right?
And you think of why we worry about stuff. We don't worry about the past generally. We actually worry about the future. We don't even worry about the present because we're in it. We worry about the future. Yeah. And we tend to over engineer scenario that the future might bring. And that adds to our worry because there's the uncertainty of which future there will be as well.
Yeah.
And worry is like paying interest on a debt you haven't drawn down.
Right.
Because you're chewing away, you're gnawing away, and your stress level goes up and all this sort of stuff. But actually, when you look at the future, there's only two things, right? So again, if you ignore the fact of doing nothing, then there's either something you can do to positively influence the future, or there's nothing you can do to positively influence the future. If there's something you can do, then you should go ahead and do it. Not worry about things, but go ahead and do it to positively change the future outcome, right? And if there's nothing you can do, then don't worry about it either, because there's nothing you can do.
Right.
So the concept of worry, right, is a completely outdated nonsense. And we either have to be in a frame of mind to say, I'm going to deal positively influence it, or there's nothing I can do to positively influence it. Either way, worrying is not a solution.
Yeah.
Why would we stress? Why would we stress about dying?
Because, well, you're going to die. I mean,
we're all going to die. Right? So why should we stress about it? Now, people stress about that. They, you know, they're worried about dying. Well, you can do something to positively influence the future. In other words, you can do things that will prolong your life, but you can't stop death coming. So don't worry about the death bit. Focus on the positives of trying to extend the life.
Yeah. Yeah. So when people, all right, so they got to start there, right? And say, well, is this something that I can do something about, or is it not? Yeah.
Correct.
And if they can do something about it, then they got to do it, right? Because the problem exists also, certainly for me, is if I know I need to do something that's going to help my life, and I sit there and I'm like, well, I really should do this, and then I just write it down and like forget about it, and then I might come back to it the next day and go, oh, I really must do that, it's really stressing me out, and then I can get on with it. But some people, they will just ignore it, won't they, and let it eat away at them until it sort of gets on top of them, and then they get stressed out of their minds and like have to go out and get fresh air because they're out of their heads, you know, on the worry.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of people that I know, you know, would rather do the ostrich strategy, right? Which is stick it in the sand and wait for it to go away. Yeah. But it doesn't go away.
No.
Well, it rarely does. And so, you know, doing nothing is a strategy, right?
Yeah.
You know, that is an option. If you understand what you're doing by doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
So for example, if there's a deadline and you're in a negotiation and you're conscious of that, doing nothing is an option, is one of the strategy that you're adopting for your negotiation. Then that, you know, that's a conscious decision to do nothing, right? But doing nothing in the hope that the outcome will change is not an option. So you know, what I do is when I need to do something and it goes a couple of days and there's, you know, I tend to put it into my diary as a meeting.
Yes.
So once it's in the diary as a meeting, I know I've got that window of time to actually do it. So, you know, other things, you know, life gets ahead of us and stops us doing things otherwise. Right. So you've got to put it in there as if you've blocked the time to go and do this particular thing, as just as if it was someone coming in and wanting a meeting with you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've just done that. I've literally started doing that and it takes away the worry and the stress. I was talking to someone, he runs a online learning company called Lessonly. And okay. He was sort of talking about the creative side of the brain versus the more sort of task orientated part of the brain, and how the stress can kind of happen because you haven't actually dealt with it. So it's like you'll think about something that you really got to do, like what we're saying, and if you put it, the moment you put it in the diary and say, well, it's okay, don't worry. I think, it, is it the left side of the brain or the right? I've forgotten.
I don't know.
I think that's preposterous anyway, because I don't think that's actually real. You know, there are all these people that talk about all sorts of things and they don't really know what on earth they're on about. But it gives you some sort of a relief. Once you say to yourself, okay, I really need to deal with this, or something really bad's going to happen, and you put it, or something, you know, not really bad, but something bad which is going to affect your life in the future. So it becomes really important. So you've got to schedule it, haven't you? You've got to put it in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, it's another way of taking that stress out, because, you know you have to deal with it, and you're sort of thinking, oh, well, you know, I meant to do it this morning, and I should have really done it then. I should have really. So sticking it in the diary as a specific action or a meeting, what it does is you're allowed then to remove it from your sort of thought list, right? So you know it's in the diary. You're not going to forget it, and you know you've got the time allocated to it to resolve it, to deal with that issue. So your mind immediately frees it up.
Right.
When I have things, you know, if I've got a list of things to do, and some of it is delegation to certain people, once I delegate that, it's gone out of my mind. And one of the things I look for when I recruit people is people I trust much more than people with skill sets.
Yeah.
I can train a skill set, but trust is a difficult thing, right? So what I do is I make sure that if I tell someone, I have the complete trust in them that they're either going to go off and do what we've agreed, or they're going to come back to me at some point and say, I have not been able to do what we've agreed. So it comes back on my list, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But what I can't take is if we agree that someone's going to do something, it comes off my list, it's gone out of my mental state, and they don't do it.
Yeah.
Right. So then both of us have got it out. You know, then we're sort of double counting the value of that task now. And that's not, like, that can't work for me, right? So I'd rather have someone with no skills that I can train than someone that I can't rely on to actually just do that small thing of following through or telling me they can't follow through.
Yeah. 100% agree. So really, we've actually separated this out, because a lot of people come from it the other angle. They'll say, well, get up earlier, do some exercise, eat the right food, meditate and all this. But actually, that is deferring the problem, isn't it, in many cases, or putting you in the right mindset to deal with the problem, yeah?
It might. It's certainly, you know, all those things I think would help your mindset, right? I mean, you know, cleaner, healthier sort of living mind is always good.
Yeah.
But unless you actually know how to deal with issues, it's giving you it's almost like putting glasses on a short-sighted person. So now he can see the problem, but unless he deals with the problem, there's still going to be a problem in front of him. It's going to be clearer.
Yeah.
It's a problem. Right.
Yeah. It's kind of like just using feel good hormones to delay handling what you need to deal with. Right.
Yeah. And maybe we can use those feel-good hormones to sort of put us in a better frame of mind of saying exactly what we spoke about earlier on, which is, I'm either going to do something to positively influence the future, which means that my likelihood of a negative result is lower, or there's nothing I can do to achieve that, in which case, don't worry about it either. And the feel-good hormones should allow us to get to that clarity quicker.
Yeah. It reminds me of your story when you put all these executives in the sea with a load of sharks.
Yeah. well, it certainly made them think clearer about about the issue. I mean, I was talking to my management team for some time about merging with a big competitor of ours, and all the management team could see was the negatives of that. They would see, you know, synergies means, well, you know, two people, one job going forward. So I'm going to lose my job, or you know, I'm going to be subservient to someone else coming in. You know, why are we doing this? And it's driven by fear, right? Yeah. And so I took them shark diving with no cages, no nets, and they didn't realize they were doing it until literally the moment I asked them to put their wetsuits on and get in the water. So afterwards, the debrief was, you know, how did you feel when you realized what you were about to do? And they said, oh my God, I hate you. And, you know, I can't believe you're making me do this. And I'm terrified and all this sort of stuff. And fear was the overriding dynamic coming out. And I said, well, okay, how did you feel when you were actually in there? And these sharks were literally, you know, a yard, a foot away from you. And they were like 15, 20 foot sharks. And they said, well, I was still absolutely petrified, but it was kind of exciting as well. And then I said, how did you feel when you got out? And they said, oh, you know, life-changing experience. Definitely don't want to do it again, but it's one of these things that I can tell my grandkids and things like that. So I said, well, you know, every time you fear the future, think about that process. Well, first of all, your fear is unreasonable typically because you over-exaggerate the outcome risk, which in that case was being eaten, which didn't happen. The second thing is when you're going through whatever the challenging thing is, you're probably going to find it at least interesting, if not exciting. And when you come out of it, you're going to be a better person. You're going to have learned something about yourself and about the situation, and you're going to be a better person for it. So, you know, if you approach every challenging situation with that kind of mentality, then you'll get through it. You know, these things are very, it's rare that if we're worrying about something that much that we can sidestep it.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting through it is the key. And, you know, Churchill used to say, when you're going through hell, the worst thing you want to do is stop. So the best thing you can do is just keep going.
Yeah. I remember that one. That's a really good one. I love Churchill. He was just amazing. So, Yes. So onto the next topic, commercial awareness, Mike. I know you know so much about this because you're involved with so many different businesses. So how do you start with commercial awareness? I mean, we all know about like the SWOT analysis. Is that where you would start?
Depends on the situation, really. But I mean, you know, again, if we try to sort of link this to sort of a work-life integration, then, you know, a lot of life is about trying to create win-wins between different entities, different parties, different people. And mm-hmm. So what you're not looking to do is you're not looking to, you know, win at the pulverization cost of the person or the entity in front of you. You're trying to say, you know, how do we both collaborate to make both of our worlds better? Okay. And that could be a marriage or it could be a business transaction. And if the business transaction is good enough, then, you know, someone with a need hooks up with someone with a product or a solution, and together they create value. Right. And so, you know, what sort of commercial awareness for me is, you know, the literal translation of entrepreneur is a between taker. Okay, in French. Okay. So between take. So in other words, it's someone that links someone with a need and someone with a solution together. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is what commercial awareness is trying to spot needs and trying to spot value. And, you know, if you look at technology today, we've got more technology than we know what to do with.
Yeah.
What's missing is the creativity of application. So where the real value proposition comes in is not in the technology itself. It's not inventing stuff per se. It's finding solutions for the inventions, finding solutions for the technology that are really, really useful. I have a business that I'm chairman of called Ultra Haptics, which is a stunning technology. It's about the sensation of touch using ultrasound in midair. Right.
Yeah.
And the technology is unbelievable. I mean, you can feel things in midair that aren't there. Okay. It's real sort of Minority Report style, but the applications are much harder to sort of perceive.
Right.
So, okay. Well, what would you use that for? And of course there are many, many applications for this. For example, there's a large car manufacturer that by the end of this year will have all of one particular model of their cars with no buttons in them, and you'd have a heads-up display in front of you, and you put your hand out and the button comes to you and you feel the button in your hand, and you can turn things up and you can turn things down by moving your hand around. And if you go over a bump, the button stays in your hand because it's actually following your hand and the button you feel isn't actually there.
Oh, wow.
You know, these are sort of applications that are incredibly innovative and of course are so logical when you listen to the application, but the technology was there before the application came about. So the technology per se is a great thing, but it's completely useless in a commercial term until you link it with an application.
Right. So it's basically just using your imagination or your understanding of the market and the other solutions and what they can connect with, what they can't connect with, and then coming up with something that is going to help people, right? I mean, we've got to solve problems, haven't we?
Yeah, and I think that's it. It's having a good eye for problems, having a good eye. And one of the challenges of today's world for our generation, right, you are my generation, yeah, opposed to millennial stroke generation X, is we've grown up with the history of technology telling us that the way to progress is if I find a problem, how do I make that easier, faster, cheaper, more efficient? And nowadays, technology has the ability of saying, well, how do I not need to do that again?
Right.
Right. And this is what we refer to as disruptive technology, because instead of the efficiency process that technology has driven since the beginning of time, you know, the first farmer was dragging his own, you know, he was troweling to plant seeds. Then he was digging furrows with a kind of a plow, but he was pushing it by hand. Then he decided to stick an ox in front of it. And then tractors came along and so on and so forth, right? And then combine, you know, so all of this thing, but it's all about efficiency, efficiency, efficiency of doing the same thing much, much faster, easier, better, cheaper.
Yeah.
But nowadays it's like, well, is there a way I just don't need to do that?
Yeah.
And I think this is the change in the way that, and it's only going to get more disruptive in this in the way that people think about it, because the speed of change of technology is going faster. And so you know, this disruptive environment, I mean, Uber was a very disruptive environment to the taxi industry. But you know, a lot of Uber drivers are going to be out of a job very soon because of driverless cars. Mm-hmm. So you know, that was a massively disruptive industry, but that probably won't last that long in the great scheme of things.
Right.
You know, and hackney carriages have been going on since the 19th century. So, you know, it took that long for that to get disrupted. But actually, it probably only take 5 or 7 years for the next one to get disrupted, and probably 2 years for the following. So I think, you know, when we're looking at these kind of ways of thinking about solutions, you know, we've got to be sensitive to, and this comes back to sort of commercial awareness, we've got to be sensitive to the power of technology allowing us to think about a difference between, you know, are we thinking about that the old way of improving engine, you know, efficiency, or are we thinking about the new way of saying, let's just disrupt this completely upside down and not worry about doing that again?
That's really interesting. I've never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Doesn't take a lot to shut me up. That's brilliant. So in the next sort of few years, you probably, yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like we share the same view that there's just so much coming at us. It's almost like you need more awareness of what's going on, but actually keeping up with what's going on is almost a full-time job in itself.
It is. I mean, you know, you've almost got to kind of look at things and go, you know what, I'm going to have a bunch of people do that for me. Yeah. So, you know, it's super important that you have a team around you. And I think this is why diversity is extremely important, right? Because, you know, the real reason for diversity is a positive reason. You know, when we look at, you know, what's going on in the world in terms of employing a broad spectrum of ages, races, genders, one of the real values of this is that the consumer dynamic is also that portfolio, right? And we need people around us that are in tune with a way of looking at things that isn't necessarily siloed to our own experiences. I mean, we're all prejudiced to an extent. Right. And I'll use that word very specifically. We're prejudiced.
Yeah, we are.
We're,
yeah,
biased. Right. So, and our bias comes from our gut feeling of what's happened to us over our lives. So, you know, if you're walking down the street and a bunch of hooded youths are walking towards you in a very sort of dodgy gait and it's sort of sunset, and you probably think to yourself, oh, my gut feeling tells me I should probably cross the road here. And yet you don't know them from Adam, and they've not done anything wrong to you. So why would you take that approach? Well, there's something in your sort of educated DNA that tells you. Now, you know, what we have to be careful of is illogical bias, right? But actually, you know, our background also tells us that, you know, we have a portfolio, a diverse group of people has a more rounded view than a single person. Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at businesses, you know, that ability to garner together a team which is very diverse is so important to get different views of the same reality and get different views of the outside opportunity.
Oh yeah, very much so. But I think it's actually quite difficult to find people who are in minorities. Certainly within, you know, I mean, I'm working with an influencer project at the moment, and it's very difficult to find sort of outwardly spoken females, for example. Yeah. Right. And the proportion, I mean, I looked at the proportion of the world's billionaires, and I looked at the list of the top 100 billionaires, and I looked at this list, and I tell you what, I reckon I could probably count the females on there in one hand out of 100. And I was like, wow. And I wonder what that's going to look like in the next 20, 30 years, and if that is going to change, or is it not? I mean, I don't know. I don't know, Mike.
Well, you know, I think that, so again, something that I talk about in the book is, you know, I'm sure that it will change, that the, you know, there'll be more and more billionaires, or the wealth of women will increase relative to men. I'm sure that will happen. And it's appropriate that it does. But I wonder, you know, so again, Oliver James was said something very interesting when I interviewed him, and he said, and it's quite controversial, but he said, you know, is it that we're getting a more balanced world, or are women becoming more like men in business? Which I'm not sure is the best solution. Because I'm not sure that men actually are ideal sort of in their own right. I mean, if you look at the scarcity of women leaders in the world, you know, that's probably a good reason why the world is still at conflict everywhere. I think if there were more women leaders, I would imagine that the world would be a better place to live in. And so, you know, if we're driving women to be more like men in business, I wonder if that's the right way around, and maybe that's a little controversial, but you know, I think it's worth us sort of reflecting on whether we're making tougher women out of business women than having, you know, a real compassionate value, which is what I think they bring to the table on any board is a very different sort of compassion than men can. I'd hate to see that disappear, sort of thing.
I know what you mean. Looking at the CEO of IBM, like Ginny, she's amazing. Like, she just, her whole presence and, like, you know, what she's done there is quite amazing. But it's very weird to see, you know, very strong women in business, because it's almost like they have to be even more tough than men. Is that what you're sort of saying?
I think so. Yeah. I think that's the thing. You know, that's what I would like to try to avoid, I guess. And I don't know whether that's a short-term thing that has to happen. You know, sometimes, you know, when we go through a sort of a process of trying to get from the pendulum dragged up one, all the way up one side, you know, it's very hard to get that pendulum to swing down and stop in the middle. It usually sort of swings the other way first.
Right.
Or it settles in the middle.
Right.
And maybe we're in that, you know, that secondary swing of the pendulum.
Yeah.
That is an inevitability before we get a balanced view of life. And I don't know whether that makes sense, you know, but I'm a great believer in most things in life being in this pendulum. So, you know, if you have things too out of kilter one way, it's highly unlikely they go back to the middle.
Right.
When you address them, because the effort needed to address them is so great that you get a reverse swing first.
Mm-hmm.
Before the balance comes through.
A real pleasure. I want to thank you so much, and I'll let you know when this is live. So where do people find your book, Mike?
So my book is on Amazon. Both books are on Amazon. It's on Kindle version, audiobook, first one is forget strategy, get results. It's a little bit of an alternative view on leadership. And the second one is live, love, work, prosper, which is kind of a fresh approach to integrating life and work as opposed to trying to find a balance.
Super. Well, thank you. It's been enlightening.
My pleasure, Nat.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections.